Okay.
So we are going to start this morning. It is January 23rd, 2016. I'm Gary Alley, and we might be getting some snow in the next day or two, according to the forecast.
And the sky, look at it.
Yeah, it's beautiful outside. And Sai might have his prayer answered. This morning we're going to be reading from Genesis 18 and from these following passages from Isaiah and Jeremiah. So if you want to turn
to
Malachi. If you want to turn there, you're welcome to Genesis 18. And we'll start with a prayer and pray that somebody goes to sleep. Lord, thank you for bringing us here. Guide us in your word. Help us to learn to follow in your steps, how you've laid things out for us in your word. May your spirit guide us in our making right decisions, good choices with our lives, and help us to be a part of bringing your kingdom here right now.
Amen.
In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
So, someone like to read Genesis 18? You could read the first, 15 verses.
Want me to start?
Sure. Gemma?
The Lord appeared to Abraham near the great tree of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, "If I found favor in your eyes, my lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under this tree. Let me get you something to eat so you can be refreshed, and then go on your way, now that you've come to your servant." "Very well," they answered, "do as you say." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah. "Quick," he said, "get three seahs of finest flour and knead it and bake some bread." Enormous amount of flour. Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice tender calf and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. He then brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While he ate, he stood near them under a tree. "Where's your wife Sarah?" they asked. "There in the tent," he said. Then one of them said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, "After I'm worn out and my Lord is old, will I now have this pleasure?" Then the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Will I really have a child now that I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord?' I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, "I did not laugh." But he said, "Yes, you did laugh." Shall I go on, or shall somebody else go on?
Sure. Let's go. Someone else want to read? Sheila?
When the men got up to leave, they looked out over Sodom. Now Abraham was walking with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, "Should I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? After all, Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all the nations on earth will pronounce blessings on one another using his name. I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Then the Lord will give to Abraham what he promised him." So the Lord said, "The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so blatant that I must go down and see if they are as wicked as the outcry suggests. If not, I want to know." The two men turned and headed towards Sodom, but Abraham was still standing before the Lord. Abraham approached and said, "Will you sweep away the godly with the wicked, along with the wicked? What if there are 50 godly people in the city? Will you really wipe it out and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 godly people who are in it?" Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the godly with the wicked, treating the godly and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of the whole earth do what is right? So the Lord replied, if I find in the city of Sodom 50 godly people, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Then Abraham said, since I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes, what if there are 5 less than 50 godly people? Will you destroy the whole city because 5 are lacking? And he replied, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. Abraham spoke to him again, what if 40 are found there? He replied, I will not do it for the sake of the 40. Then Abraham said, may the Lord not be angry so that I may speak. What if 30 are found there? And he replied, I will not do it if I find 30 there. Abraham said, since I've undertaken to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 are found there? And he replied, I will not destroy it for the sake of the 20. Finally, Abraham said, may the Lord not be angry so that I may speak just once more. What if 10 are found there? And he replied, I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. The Lord went on his way. When he had finished speaking to Abraham, then Abraham returned home.
Nice. What do you say?
Just like Abraham thought he'd covered it with the 10. He thought there could at least be 10.
Mm-hmm.
He was generous in his estimation.
So who's he thinking of?
Lot.
Yeah, Lot, Dan.
His family?
Yeah.
But that's only 6.
Right.
What about his son?
Maybe he's hoping there's another couple out.
Right, 6, right? The 2 daughters and the 2 son-in-laws. But they weren't so righteous.
But they
didn't
have any kids.
Well, that still wouldn't cover it. So,
right,
did
right.
Anybody else?
Unless they had kids, but I guess they were too young.
What always strikes me is that 10 then becomes, first of all, for Israel, you know, you only have a minyan when you have 10.
Right.
Yeah.
And in terms of intercession, you need 10 to pray for a city. You need 7,000 to pray for a land, a nation, but it's 10.
According to who?
Well, if you go through school, you see it repeated. And
probably
it's
from here.
Probably from here
yeah.
only.
Yeah.
But it's certainly something when we're praying for Jerusalem or praying for a nation, this number, you know, that we need 10.
Because 2 can set a legion fleeing.
That's true too, yeah, absolutely.
That would be a circular argument though, because it starts here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then you can't reach back to here. Why is it starting here with 10?
It doesn't start, it ends with 10. And
no,
he doesn't even have 10.
No, being the idea that for 10 people, a city is spared. So people who use that to pray for cities are basing it here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they didn't have 10 people.
Maybe Abraham bargained to 10, I don't know.
He figured he'd already pushed it down already.
He's a good
80,
arrow,
80,
he got it down.
He figured he had it covered.
Yeah.
He'd already brought it down 80%.
Yeah,
so
that's
a pretty,
yeah,
good,
pretty good
bargaining. Yeah.
I don't bargain that well.
Never pay more than half price in the old city, right?
Right.
So you got a really good deal. Okay, so we just read a very famous story, and I'm sure we've talked about this passage so many times over the last, at least my last 20 years. And but let's just start off in verse 1. Where was Abraham? In verse
Hebron.
Okay,
Hebron.
Right. The Oaks of Mamre, which is in Hebron. But where specifically is he in this story?
The entrance to the tent.
Right, and right there in his tent. And what is, as Christians, what do we usually call Abraham? What's his kind of moniker, his title?
Father
of
nations,
father of faith. Because Paul talks about, I think, Abraham in that way. In Jewish tradition, outside of, say, the New Testament, what's Abraham often connected to? Not faith, but
hospitality.
Have y'all heard that before?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's very common, especially in this land. And this story is kind of the paradigm for why he's the father of hospitality.
Well, I've forgotten it, but aren't the 3 words, don't they all make up Eshel or something like that? What are the 3?
Which words?
Which ones?
That's what I don't remember. I haven't got it in this Bible.
Eshel, you mean?
Avram Sarah.
No, no, Eshel, I think, are they Ochel?
Ochel. Shtia. Lechem.
Could well be.
Lechem one, two.
And then
Lina.
I don't know.
Okay, so what happens here?
The hotel in Ariel is called Eshel.
What happens here?
I've forgotten that.
What's his hospitality like? What does he do?
Rushes off to get his woman to make bread.
It's lavish.
Okay, so first off,
he washes feet.
Right. Washes feet, which is a common thing we know in this area where feet are dirty from all the dust and sand.
And even before that is the bowing low to the ground. I mean, his sort of honoring of these three. I mean,
even before that, he runs out to meet them.
Yes, he runs like a servant, because servants
That's
run,
true.
Not great lords like Abraham.
And it says day. Here, the Lord appeared to Abraham. So the Lord is one of the three.
Well,
but how does he know that?
He doesn't know that yet, does he?
No.
Yeah. We haven't come to... Yeah, that's... But before we start talking about these visitors, let's talk about what Abraham's doing. He's running. He's washing their feet. He bowed down. What else did he do?
And even before he's running, he's like sitting at the entrance of the tent.
Looking.
At midday.
Yeah, at midday. Midday, I would be inside the tent...
Dead beat.
In complete shade. Of course, maybe you want some fresh air. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's under the oak trees.
That's right.
It's at the oak trees, but that I don't know. Do the oak trees cover his whole tent? It also says he was sitting in the entrance of his tent.
Yeah, that's where it says specifically.
And that's where he looked out at the road and he saw them. He ran out there to bring them.
Mine said he lifted up his eyes. Was he bowing down to someone? It's just a proper phrase for looking.
It's the Hebraic way. Like he lifted up his eyes.
It means you're about to look.
So he washed their feet. He made bread. As Gemma noted, it's like around 20 quarts of flour. Mm-hmm. So it's a feast for like many people, not just for three people. So he was super generous. This type of the amount of what he's making, like for a king. Right? They drink. Let's see.
He gets a cup.
Sorry?
He gets a cup.
A cup.
Okay.
Oh, right. So he gives him meat, right?
Another similarity with the story of the prodigal son.
Right. Because the father runs out to his son, right?
I mean, that's a lot of meat.
And would he do this for anybody? He was inspired to do it.
This is the great. You know, in Jewish tradition, he would do this for everybody. It was his heart of hospitality. And then you could also interpret and say, oh, he knew that these were special guests. This is like angels, or this was the Lord, or whatever. And
but
so
is that the Lord appeared to him. So the Lord, something had to do with the Lord there.
Yeah, but
that's later.
He says shlosha anashim.
Yeah.
He says three people.
Yeah.
So from a distance, he didn't know. They just look like three people.
Yep. So from the context of the story, I mean, if you read the story straight up, he doesn't know who these three people are. It's just three people until later on.
Ooh. I wonder how many hours
he addresses
and the flower.
And to go, he goes to the herd and
first
gets
off,
it. First
my,
of all,
my, lo- my, my Lord there is not the Lord's name. It's like master. It's like
it's one. It's
in Hebrew,
it's.
I know he's talking to one person, like sir. It's like what he's saying.
But in Hebrew, the very very first words, is it not Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh?
It's not. No, it's Adonai. It's Adonai. Just like today in modern Hebrew, you say Adonai.
Yeah. I didn't realize.
So my Lord, my master.
My Bible's actually wrong.
My sir, whatever you want to call it.
What they have capital letters in your Bible?
Yes.
Oh. Now I have a note here. I have a note here that the Masoretic text has pointed it Adonai, which they say here is reserved for God. And this may reflect later scribal activity. The scribes, knowing it was the Lord, may have put the proper pointing with the word instead of the more common I don't need.
Yeah, but like Sharon says, that's an interpretation. We know right. from the end of the story that it is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh.
It's an interpretation that goes back to the Masoretes.
But these three guys, three Anashim, turn up.
Yeah.
And but so...
Like you, did you point it out? Someone here pointed out that it's he's addressing one person, so there must have been like a leader.
Right.
Because he says...
in verse 10.
Yeah.
Also in verse 3, if I found favor in your eyes, it's singular. Don't pass by me, singular.
And then in verse 13, suddenly becomes Adonai.
Right, right, yeah.
So how does that work?
No, it's 14, you mean, it's Yahweh, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh.
Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, also 13, yeah.
Right, well, welcome to...
In 13, it's still Adonai, and then it...
Both of them are Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh.
What I would say is, welcome to 2,000 years of interpretation. Because interpretation even started within the Bible.
I want answers.
Right. Interpretation even started within the Bible. The Bible was trying to interpret itself as it's being compiled and written before Jesus. So, so all the things that you're bringing up are what... All the readers like us so long ago also were asking these same questions.
And so it's not living Bible that says, "Oh Lord, like my God."
Right.
Oh Lord, what is this?
Where in verse 3?
Verse 3.
Oh no, yeah, but there, Lord, it's like Lord. Sir, like oh.
Right.
Is it capitalized or?
No, it's not capitalized.
Just a phrase.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Lord. Right.
And verse 4 and 5, it's plural.
4 and 5.
You may all wash your feet.
Yeah. Right, no. There's three people here. But it looks like they've got one person in charge, right?
Right.
So, and on top
right,
of that...
There's three singular, right? And then there's four. Yeah, so it goes back and forth. Yeah, you're right.
And so this is the fun stuff about if you really read your Bible and you look at little things like this, you'll notice it's going in and out of singular and plural. And does that mean anything? Is there some significance to it? It's all a part of the...
Yeah, like what would anybody be doing walking in the heat of the day? You know?
Looking for
out
a
in Hebron?
Oh, it's a serious... They're on a serious mission here.
Yeah, but I mean...
It doesn't say they're walking.
It says they appear.
True.
They're riding the cloud.
It does, you're right. There they are. They're just standing there all of a sudden.
They're just standing.
Right.
The best description of Daft Go we've had.
I was just trying to make it practical. Like, if he has to run out to see them, then they must be in a road. And for them to just be standing there is strange. But
he's saying that's the same thing. You're also interpreting it.
I'm interpreting that they're walking down the road. But you're right. It says literally they're standing.
Suddenly they were standing.
Suddenly they're standing there.
Well, even if they're standing, they're standing outside the tent. He's sitting at the entrance to his tent, under the tree or not. And
no, not under the tree. I've now decided because look, right. When he runs out to get them, he says, "Why don't you sit under the tree and rest while I do all this stuff for you?"
Very good.
So at least the distance he's run is the distance
he's
to
moving.
The tree.
He's moving towards them. Put it that way.
We usually say that one of the three is the Lord.
Right.
But could it be possible that all of them are?
That is how Augustine, the early church, started interpreting this as the Trinity. So there's all kinds of fun interpretations that develop from this. Definitely.
But when you get to the next chapter, which is the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, it's very clearly the two angels that were with, quote, the Lord beforehand.
Sure. It's like you're looking at a 3D film and you got to wear the glasses and sometimes it looks out of focus. And
let's just go back to the hospitality.
So
he runs through, he washes their feet.
Verse 6.
He makes bread, he kills a calf.
Okay, the bread, we mentioned first off, it's a large amount. It's much more bread than you need for three people. So it's very generous. What kind of kemah is it? What kind of flour is it?
Nice stuff.
It's very nice flour.
Well, today it's semolina. Today it's not as nice, but in the Bible, actually, it's the fine flour.
It's very fine flour. Okay.
When you read the offerings and it says fine flour.
So it's high quality.
Yeah.
And then what kind of meat? First off, you know, meat is not a common, you don't eat that every day in the ancient world. Even in the modern world, that you're not in a first world country, meat is not so common. You usually eat them for like weddings or banquets, special occasions. So this, it's expensive having meat. And even specifically, what kind of meat? The calf, right?
Soft, good calf.
Yeah, so a calf, and it veal, yeah. Yeah. It says it's rach, you know, it's tender.
I mean, if you go to a steak restaurant and order one steak, it's expensive. But how much more, like the whole calf? I mean.
So everybody can understand that this is a very special meal. It's not just like he's giving them some old bread and some
water.
What
he's saying, though. The first thing he says is, I'll give you a piece of bread.
Right, that's right.
And then he comes up with this
big meal. Dinner. Yeah.
Well, no wonder he's in a hurry, because it's going to take hours and hours, you know? Even hurrying. To kill a calf, skin
I don't think they had microwaves in those days, did they?
No. I mean,
wonder if they spent the night there.
Yeah, for which time it would be too late.
Yeah.
Or maybe he killed the calf and just took off the fillets and threw them on the fire.
Or they ate the bread first.
Then what about he brought curds and milk?
The servant's right. Doing the calf, yeah, but it's interesting that he asked Sarah to do the bread.
Yeah.
Because she could have, I mean, the servant could have done the bread too.
Maybe so you Sarah's could say that's in charge of the bread making and she has servants do it. You know, Sarah, maybe. You make sure bread happens.
Or maybe it's this honor thing where, like, I'm personally making your bread. Part of the.
What about curds and milk? What are curds?
Butter.
So what's unkosher here?
The whole bag shoe.
Not necessarily.
Milk and calf.
They waited 3 hours?
There's eight.
No, it's not the milk in three hours.
It's not a gdi.
No, I'm just saying, I'm talking about what is modern kosher.
No, modern kosher, okay.
You don't mix milk and meat.
Yeah.
I have a Jewish friend who...
says don't cook a little lamb or goat in its mother's milk.
Right.
And well, it's not a little lamb or goat, it's a little...
Well, the other thing is Abraham is not... He's not even Jewish in that sense. Right? This is before Sinai. So.
But he is circumcised.
He is.
Can we just go back to curds a minute?
He is now circumcised.
Curds
and now
is butter, is it?
Chema. What do you call that? He is obligated to the Torah.
Right.
From last chapter.
Okay, so one last question about this meal. Who are these visitors? I know we just said that we don't know, but what?
Well, if they were dressed a certain way, that would be a clue.
Okay.
So they might have been dressed, well-dressed. It doesn't make sense that he would do this for every single person, because if you did that, you'd be opening yourself to, you know, bandits who would see you had all this wealth. I mean,
right. But you remember, according to Genesis 14, he took 400 guys with him to go grab a lot back when he was kidnapped. So he's got basically a little village. It's not just him, and he's surrounded by an army, basically, if you take it. I mean, so he's not really worried about bandits.
No, but she's right. She's right.
Just run out of camps.
Nevertheless, if people, three people turn up, do you really, any of us, do we ever basically kill the fatted calf every time somebody turns up? I mean, you know, a cup of coffee or come and wash your feet and maybe make some bread. But this is a bit over the top for just...
Do we even have the calf to kill when they come?
Well, if...
Or do we just ask the question, when someone comes over, do we do the best we can for them?
Or if I go back to the first verse, the Lord appeared to Abraham. So why does it start that way? Maybe Abraham clued in right away. Because he does have a relationship with the Lord and seems to recognize him every time he communicates with him.
That's a good point.
Right.
This is more than hospitality, in other words, right?
Well, let's say it's...
If you've ever gone to an Arab home in the Middle East, this is pretty typical.
Well, but all the foods, is he asking these people to join? I mean, he's got a big crowd. I mean, it's
for
old people. Is he asking them to join, or is he making a special meal just for these three? if he's making just a special meal for these three, then, like you said, it's kind of over the top. Then I would say, yeah, well.
But isn't that the point?
Yeah, it's kind of the point.
For instance, like 10 years ago or so, I was traveling from Petra up to Amman in Jordan. And if you've been on that road, you look out, there's nothing. Nothing, nothing. And the driver needed a bathroom.
Your so, driver.
Our driver.
He was an American.
So, no, there's no bush around. Nothing, nothing. So, finally, we see this little village up ahead. We stop, and we go to the supermarket, and we ask if we can use a bathroom, you know, because finally communicating, there's no bathroom there. But the owner of the supermarket says, you can come to my house and use the bathroom. So we drive to his house.
Which is not closed, probably.
And then we finally use the bathroom, but just by being in his house, and he brings out stuff, you know, it starts with the tea, and he put a whole meal in front of us. And it took time to make, because they didn't know, like, after we arrived, then, you know, I don't know, his wife was somewhere else, then she came back, and she was, like, making all kinds of salads, and egg, and pita, whatever they had, you know, hummus. We spent 2 hours there.
How many people were you?
Three.
Just ask.
Yeah, just by chance.
Are you the Lord? And Gary, then, can I get back to the point that I made? I feel the Lord was there. Too.
Yeah, gifts.
The Lord and then the three men. So the fact that the Lord was there is why something special was happening.
Or can
I don't know if he's called or said something, but the Lord appeared, then the three men.
Or can the first verse be kind of a summary of what's going to happen?
Yeah. So that we as a reader know, it doesn't mean Abraham knew.
Yeah. Because if you read the next verse, Abraham sees three guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it could...
And if he thought it was God, would he really offer food?
Okay, so this brings me to my question I've been trying to get to. If it's the Lord, and traditionally we understand these Anashim as who? At least two of them?
Angels.
As angels. And why do we interpret it that way?
Because of one God?
Because of the next chapter. Yeah. You turn to chapter 19, what's it say in verse 1?
The two angels.
The two angels.
Okay, now this is a bit, we're kind of reading into it. It says Malachim, and Malach in Hebrew, can mean angel, but really it means messenger. That's it, because it's used of humans as well. Like the king sends a messenger to some place. And eventually this becomes to be understood as an angel, because angel is a messenger of God. So you see that nice, how it fits together. So anyways, we usually understand this as kind of like God's messengers, angels, right? And this brings Sharon's question here. Can angels eat?
And do you give angels food?
And do you give angels food?
Sacrifice to the Lord, you don't...
Well, Gideon tried to give an angel food.
Okay.
But he didn't actually eat it. He poured it out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and what about also, let's say, Judges 13, verse 16? Do you remember that story?
No.
Judges what?
13, verse 16. Good job. Does someone want to read that?
That is Manoah. Yeah.
Can you just read it?
The angel of the Lord replied, even though you detain me, I will not eat any of your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, offer it to the Lord. Manoah did not realize that it was the angel of the Lord.
So there's already a tradition in the Bible, and it goes into the Second Temple period with Jesus, where it's understood angels don't eat. And all of your interpreters, Philo, Josephus, rabbinic writings, and other Second Temple writings from that time period, are saying, even though it says in Genesis 18, verse 8, verse 8. Genesis 18, verse 8. It says that they were eating.
They ate. The other interesting point is he didn't know it was an angel, so to him it just looked like a man.
Right. And so that would make sense with why Abraham saw three people, and, right? So all of your interpreters, Philo, Josephus, and so on, understood that it was an illusion. It looked like they were eating, and they were going through the motions, but they weren't really eating. So that's kind of a funny little...
I don't like that. While he ate, he stood near them under a tree, so he didn't eat with them.
No, he was serving them.
No, they ate, it says.
Yeah, so why is it an illusion that they...
Because of what we just read about the angel.
Angels not eating.
Yeah, in Judges.
So I missed that last sentence. It's an illusion to what?
Not an illusion. It's an illusion. Illusion.
Illusion. Oh, okay, so it's not really happening. It looks like it's happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not a hallucination, but...
But it looked like... But
yeah, right, right.
Is anything too hard for the Lord?
Right, right.
Jesus was able to eat after the resurrection.
Right.
I know. Second Temple Judaism doesn't necessarily know that.
All I'm trying to point out is that just pay attention to your Bibles and notice these little things. Maybe you never thought about it before.
I can't remember your name. What's your website?
Anne.
I love Anne's comment that she made a few minutes ago.
The Lord can do anything?
No, about... Abraham had such a good relationship with the Lord that he really did recognize who he was. And I think we should be able to say the same thing. I really like that. Yeah.
Well, I think probably the deeper part is God revealed himself. I mean, I'm not going to recognize God, but if he reveals himself to me, then I may.
Not may, my sheep hear my voice. I think we do recognize God, and we know when something's of God and when it's not. And we know when we hear something and it's of God and it's of not.
I'm agreeing with that, but I'm saying not seeing, just doing.
Okay, let's push on. We don't have a lot of time left. We've talked about the hospitality. We've talked about the angels a bit here. So why have they come to Abraham? What's their point?
To tell Sarah she's going to have a kid.
Sarah's going to have a kid. Did Sarah know about this beforehand? She did? Sarah knew about this beforehand? Before this story? No, she didn't. Who knew about this before this story?
Abraham
knew about it. When did Abraham first find out that Sarah was going to have a kid?
Last chapter.
Chapter 17. That was the first time... If you look at...
He was reading the Bible.
21, verse 21 of 17.
Yeah, 17, 21. What's it say there?
My covenant I will put with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear this time next year.
Okay. So, when it says this time next year, what's the Hebrew say?
La'moed hazeh bashana ha'heret.
Which verse are you in?
21 of chapter 17.
It starts even at 15, he says it, in 17, 19, he repeats himself.
Mm-hmm. Right, but the specific verse that we find in Genesis 18, verse 14, is just like we find in Genesis 17, 21. So, Genesis... 17:21. They're equivalent there. And specifically, I'm talking about this word moed. This time next year, this appointed time. And it will be used later on in 21, verse 2 as well. Someone want to read that? 21 verse 2.
So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him.
Okay, so this is translated appointed time. Moed. Okay, let's go to the Haftarah here. Let's go to Isaiah 33. We'll come back to Genesis 18. You know where I'm going? Oh, you saw some fun. Okay, would somebody like to read verses?
Where are we going again?
Isaiah 33, verse 17 to 24. Maybe Gemma, would you like to read that?
Yeah.
Isaiah 33, verse 17.
Your eyes will see the king in his beauty and view a land that stretches afar. In your thoughts, you will ponder the former terror. Where is that chief officer? Where is the one who took the revenue? Where is the officer in charge of the towers? You will see those arrogant people no more, people whose speech is obscure, whose language is strange and incomprehensible. Look on Zion, the city of our festivals. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a peaceful abode, a tent that will not be moved. Its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its ropes broken. There the Lord will be our mighty one. It will be like a place of broad rivers and streams. No galley with oars will ride them. No mighty ship will sail them. For the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. It is he who will save us. Your rigging hangs loose. The mast is not held secure. The sail is not spread. Then an abundance of spoils will be divided. Even the lame will carry off plunder. No one living in Zion will say, I am ill. And the sins of those who dwell there will be forgiven.
Okay.
What on ever is the connection?
What? Here, the Moed.
Okay, here we go.
It's the Moed.
Here comes, it's the city of Moedim.
Here comes the fun part.
Okay.
Yes. First off, it is very interesting. What city is being talked about here?
Jerusalem.
Okay,
again.
Jerusalem. Zion, which is another name for, it's a code name for Jerusalem. And as we've pointed out over the last few months, that it's interesting how these haftarot that we've been looking at have been really connected to Jerusalem. And here's another one. So it makes you feel like whoever came up with these haftarot were living in Jerusalem. But it's interesting how where is Jerusalem located geographically? Is it
due north? Due north of Hebron.
Yeah, is it like, okay, it's due north of Hebron, but is it
it's
is
in
it,
the hills?
It's in the mountains. Is it on the ocean?
No.
Is it on a lake or a river? And so what is Isaiah 33 talking about here?
It's all about the riggings hanging loose and your mast being...
Right, it's talking about all this ship terminology. You would think it would be more about Jaffa or...
A place of broad rivers and streams.
Yeah, or Egypt, or... It's interesting. But what I wanted to point out is what Sharon just mentioned. If you go to Isaiah 33, verse 20... Sharon pointed out, what happens in Zion? What happens in Jerusalem? It's a city of what?
Festivals.
Festivals. Again. So, again. Hebrew, it's Moed, this word here.
Oh, it's not Chagim.
Yeah. So, this word, Moed, has many different meanings. But they're all basically related to something that's been appointed. It can be a time, like we saw with Sarah giving birth. It can be a meeting place. It can be a place of like a festival, because a festival is an appointed time or situation.
That's interesting, because you say Moedim L'Simcha, don't you, when you may the appointed time continue.
Right. And even later on in Daniel, people in the end times in eschatology love, I think, this word, if I remember it, you know, about the appointed time for the end or the future, it takes on this eschatological idea in Daniel, since Daniel is like an apocalyptic writing. But I don't want to go there right now. I want to just hang on this idea of what is Moed and how does it relate to our story in Genesis 18. Where does Moed first appear in the Bible? And it's an easy one.
Yeah.
It's in chapter 1, the creation, right?
Oh, right. La Moedim is part of the job of the stars.
When God creates the sun and the moon and the stars, their job is to help make appointed, like, seasons is kind of usually how it's translated in a lot of your translations. The years, the days, and so on.
The appointed times.
The appointed times. So we come to the story with Abraham and Sarah, and there's going to be an appointed time where this is going to happen, this birth is going to take place. There's one other thing that I found curious about this whole story with Abraham. In Genesis 18, where does he first see his visitors? Where is he at? Where is he standing?
Petach ha'ohel.
Okay, Petach ha'ohel. So the opening of the tent.
So I was asking if you're going to compare Abraham and Joshua.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Joshua always stands in the opening of the
tent. Yeah, indirectly I'm going to. He's standing there. It gets mentioned again. And then another place it really gets mentioned in the story of Genesis 18, who else is in the Petach HaOhel?
Sarah.
What is she doing there?
Laughing.
She's laughing. She's hearing that this thing about her son's going to be born. So you've got Abraham there, and you've got Sarah. It's interesting how, you know, you're reading it and you're thinking, well, it's just a place. It's like I'm at the door of my house. It's not, who cares?
And but they're not sharing this information. It's like one-one stories. It's like she doesn't know that he said it, or it certainly isn't clear that they talked about this or he shared any of his experiences, really.
You mean from chapter 17?
No. He hasn't. She,
but
know,
in general.
Right.
Maybe.
Okay, but they're both standing in Petach HaOhel. And so here's, let's go back to the Moed, and so I was trying to figure out how do we connect Genesis 18 and Isaiah 33 here. We're talking about Jerusalem, if you're looking at Isaiah 33.
You know, the end of the verse goes on, it says, the tent shall not be done, the courts shall stay, the stakes shall not be pulled up like an eternity, a full Jerusalem.
You're right, it mentions Ohel. In Isaiah 33, it mentions a tent. Thank you. That's my connection here. When do these words come together? When does
Ohel
tent
Moed
appointed? Yeah, what is the Ohel Moed? What is that?
Tabernacle, the appointed.
Okay,
tabernacle.
Well, it's not quite the tabernacle, but
well, it's the tent of meeting.
It's usually translated tent of meeting. It appears over 100 times in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. You can't read one verse in those three books and not find the tent of meeting.
And it's in Hebrew, it's the
Ohel Moed.
You haven't written Ohel with a vav. You just put a dot. But really, it's with a vav.
Right.
It's with a vav.
It doesn't matter.
Right. So the English. So let me just give you an example. Let's go to, say, Numbers 10:10. Oh, wait, no. Numbers 8:24. Actually, that's just kind of a... Let me go back to the very first time it appears there. Exodus 27... Let's go to Exodus 27, verse 21. In the tent of meeting, what do your translations have there?
I've got tent of meeting.
Tent of meeting.
Outside the curtain that shields the Ark of the Covenant of the Law, Aaron and his sons are to keep the lamps burning before the Lord from evening until morning. This is to be a lasting ordinance among the Israelites for the generations to come.
Yeah. There, Aaron and his sons are to wash themselves with water. You present sacrifices there. Kill the bull before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. I'm just reading verses throughout Exodus here.
Joshua wouldn't leave the tent. He used to stay there all the time.
Right. Yeah, Joshua was there with Moses. So it's, in a sense, there's the tabernacle originally, if you read Exodus, and then there's this tent of meeting, which is something separate. But eventually it starts to be brought together as the same thing. And like, let's see here, if you...
I mean, some people would say it is the same thing. The only problem is that they're in two different places. One's outside right. the camp, one's in the middle of the camp.
Yeah.
So let me understand. You're saying that this theme developed, or you're saying that we can read back from later time into this?
You're talking about Isaiah 33 and Genesis 18?
Yeah, this concept that you're talking about.
I don't know, but this really popped out at me. I don't know what I would...
He's saying there's links in the language between these two passages. These passages were put together way back.
Right, time of Jesus.
In the time of Jesus. So we're trying to investigate why these two passages were linked together.
Yeah. Okay, the question I'm asking is, are you suggesting that they started there and we can read back, or that they developed and this is the beginning and then they keep developing?
Developing what part?
Well, that the concept keeps getting expanded and turns into tent of meeting.
I'm saying we don't know, really.
Yeah, okay.
Nothing's ever been...
But it can say that Abraham's tent was a tent of meeting.
Okay, so I'm reading back. Yeah, that's what we all do. But the question is... what?
Correct.
Yeah, what do we see? Is it interesting? Is
we
God
see a
speaking?
Sacrifice,
so,
a fine flour, and a...
At the opening of the tent, we know that this appears in the story of Abraham, we just read a few times.
Mm-hmm.
If you go and look it up in your concordances in the Bible, if you put these two words together, where else does it appear? What other tent is it related to?
Tent of meeting.
It only is related to the tent of meeting, basically, in connection to the tent of meeting. So I find that curious.
The only time you talk about Petach Oel is when you're talking about the tent of meeting.
Or with the Abraham story. Yeah. And so this was a cursory look. I didn't go in completely. I mean, I have it all there and I read through them all. So I might have missed something, but from what
there's,
I saw.
I don't know if he uses exactly that phrase, but the one other time I'm thinking of is in Numbers, when all the people have to stand at the entrance of their tents.
Right, but it's in relation to Moses going into the tent of meeting.
Yeah.
So that's the only, but it's still connected.
Yeah, it's still connected.
Yeah. So that's the only possible exception, but it's still related, stronger related.
So really, we're going back to my question. When I read it, I said, "What on earth is the connection? How did these two been put together?" And the theme answer is there's a whole connection between him sitting at the gate, the opening of his tent, and we come later to the tent of meeting and the appointed time. There are really two links between these two passages. That's what we're saying, isn't it?
That, well, it's the same link.
Yeah.
That Moed is related to an appointment.
Well, they don't come together in the Isaiah passage, but she's saying we take the Ohed theme and the Moed theme, put them together, and we have both of those in Abraham.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And what happens in...
There's another... Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
In verse 17, the king. You'll see the king in his beauty, right?
Yes.
It's not exactly in our chapter, but in the chapter before it says, kings will come from you. That's part of the covenant.
Right.
So, and like this son that's going to be born exactly a year later.
Right.
And then out of that son, there's going to be this covenant that kings will come from it. So you could kind of see a connection there.
Yeah.
With a future king kind of theme.
I mean, the king is who?
The Messiah.
Well, why would you even say it's God?
Okay, God.
That is, it's God. And the tent becomes the tabernacle, or it's the same thing. The tabernacle becomes the temple, right? It's evolving. And then the temple becomes what? In Jewish literature, in tradition, today, when we say the temple, or we're thinking of the temple, what really is Jerusalem or Zion? Like when Jesus talks in Matthew, he says, it's Matthew 5 about your footstool. Is it Jerusalem's your footstool or the temple or whatever? Jerusalem comes to represent where God lives.
Yeah.
Matthew's taken that from Chronicles, isn't it? Or is it Kings?
Right, it's in the biblical tradition. And so, and what happens in the temple? What happens in the...
Well, that's the interesting
thing.
What's
the point of the temple?
Because the temple, there's sacrifices.
Right.
So you could say there's a parallel there with the calf and the fine flour that's for sacrifice. Yeah. But the tent of meeting is not, in its stories in the Torah, is not known for sacrifices.
Well, they have them in front of it.
Maybe.
They kill this or that.
But like it's the Spirit of the Lord fills the tent. It's much more a charismatic kind of Joshua. It's yeah, you have prophecy going on. Joshua's in there and he gets filled with the Spirit.
Right.
And it's kind of different than the whole tent.
But what I'm saying is it's evolving over the years.
Okay.
The tent.
They're being combined.
Originally the tent was like you're saying, had more of a specific function, but it starts to become brought together as the tabernacle, or even it was a tabernacle, it's debated, right?
Right.
And in the tabernacle, you have sacrifices.
Yeah.
And then you go to the temple, the tabernacle becomes the temple. And in Jerusalem, like, you know, for Pesach, in the time of Jesus, if you couldn't be in Jerusalem for Pesach, then you would be, say, in the Mount of Olives. Or the further out you go, it's like you're in Jerusalem.
Right.
The ground is progressively
getting bigger,
and the holiness, you know, it's all this interesting sanctification of the ground. And in a sense, that kind of continues on today with everything that goes on here. But here's my final point before we close, is, so I'm thinking about this whole story with Genesis 18. And so on one hand, you have, she's going to have a son, Isaac. And then what's the other part of the chapter, Genesis 18?
Sodom.
We're going to destroy Sodom. Mm-hmm. That is our job. And we know that eventually it becomes two of the messengers. And what's Abraham's whole part before the destruction of Sodom?
To bargain.
To fight.
To fight for the Tzaddikim.
For the Tzaddikim. To try to save them. And it comes down to 10 that are... Like, we'll save it for 10. And in Genesis 18, it talks about, he says, will you destroy it for, if you've got righteous people that are in it? And specifically, says something about Laset.
At the end?
Where is that?
Their sins will be carried?
In Genesis 18?
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, no, we'll go with that.
Well, that said to forgive or to...
Yeah, to... We just read it. Genesis 18. This is what happens when you don't have it all down to a punch.
I will spare the whole place for their sake.
Yeah, where is that?
26.
32.
Okay. Yes. Genesis 18:26. So the Lord replied, if I find in the city of Sodom 50 good people, I will spare the whole place for their sake. And it says here, Ve'nasati lechol ha'makom be'avoram.
And the verse before it says, will not the judge all the earth do right? So...
And even before that, after the angels leave, it says in verse 19, the reason he has blessed Abraham, he says, because I know he will command his children and his household after him, and they will keep the way of the Lord to do staka umishpat.
Right.
And then in Isaiah 33, it's before our passage, but specifically, verse 5, it says, God will be lifted up because he dwells on high, and he has filled Zion with mishpat utztaka. So he flips it around. Then the next verse, Vehaya emunat itecha, chosen yeshuot, chokhmat ledaat. It's interesting, but it mentions the et there, the time. It's a different word for time, but it's a...
And et is also mentioned in Genesis 18.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to close, another verbal connection is Genesis 18, verse 26, where it says, "Ve'nasati lechol amakom be'avogam," I will spare the whole place for their sake. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to Isaiah 33, verse 24, mm-hmm. It says in the English here, "No resident of Zion will say, 'I am ill.' The people who live there will have their sin forgiven." And Isaiah had a curious parallel for Jerusalem, another name for Jerusalem. You remember from Isaiah's very first chapter of his book, what did he call Jerusalem?
Faithful city?
Kiryat Ne'amanah? No. Yeah, he called him Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, Sodom. Kisdom.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. Amoran.
Isaiah 1. And so it's kind of like Isaiah turns the tables on Jerusalem. You're the holy city. This is where God is. But you've become Sodom and Gomorrah. But in both cases, Abraham fights that God will spare, even if only for a few of the righteous. And Isaiah 33, 24 says, the people who live there will have their sin forgiven. It's the same word, or the same root, at least.
Yeah, in chapter 1, verse 9, if the Lord of hosts had not given us a small remnant, we would have been like Sodom and Amorah.
Isaiah 1,
verse 9.
So, that's it. And I think it's pretty interesting,
yeah,
to think about Moed, and it kind of humbles us to remember that in the story of Genesis 18, we think, oh, Abraham's fighting for these pagans, you know, these 10 that are in this horrible city, and yet Isaiah, in a sense, has turned it where Abraham's actually fighting for us. We are living in stone.
Can I just ask you a question about, is there an actual word in the Hebrew in Genesis 1, Moed, or is it just the et word?
In Genesis 1?
Genesis 1, Moed.
Where is it in Genesis 1?
It's in day 4.
It's verse 14. All right, Shabbat Shalom.